9, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, your host, and this, as every week, is the mothership of DSR when we talk about the world. And we do so with some of our best and most respected friends. And of course, that begins with Her Eminence Corey Shockey of the American Enterprise Institute. How are you doing, Corey?
I am exceedingly well and still smiling about the Deep State Radio nerd who on Twitter said the nation's facing disaster if I give any less an answer than that.
It's true. 9 years in, you've managed to be exceedingly well through some very rough times. And of course, also holding up his end is Edward Luce of the Financial Times. How you doing, Ed?
I'm all right, I suppose.
I could have gone a long time without the visual of Ed holding up his end.
Yeah. Well, it's something we all have to live with. And we are joined today by a special guest, Mehdi Hasan. Mehdi is, of course, an award-winning journalist, and he is also now not just a journalist, but an entrepreneur, where he is the CEO and founder of Zateo, a new media company. Welcome, Mehdi.
Thank you for having me, David.
Yay!
And thank you for that endorsement, Corey. That, I think you've just subscribed there with that yay.
Well, I looked at your YouTube channel and you said, please subscribe. And there were all these people who are like, you know, I live in far corners of the world and I'm subscribing. You have a great base of admirers. I am one of that great base of admirers. Can you tell us in, briefly what the concept behind Zateo is?
David, thank you. And it's great to be talking to foreign policy eminences like you all, because I just checked with my team and we have subscribers as far afield as Chad. I don't know who the one subscriber in Chad is, but I want to know what they want to hear from this company. We are called Zateo, which comes from the ancient Greek word going back to Socrates, to seek out, to search for, to find the truth at a time when you and I, David, have discussed many times back in the day how much truth is under assault in this country. And I basically set up this platform after leaving MSNBC, partly because I wanted to be my own boss, which is fun, but also because I do believe that we need a media platform in this country which can do accountability journalism, that can hold both politicians and our media industry to account, that can say things as they are, that cannot hide behind lazy euphemisms, both sidesism, things that have frustrated me for many years. So as I said when I announced the company a couple of weeks ago, we did a soft launch. It's a subscriber model, so kind of the subscriptions are rolling in as we prepare to do the big launch next month. But the premise of the company is that we are not going to run away from terms like the F word, fascism, in relation to Donald J. Trump. We're not going to run away from the R word, racism. We're not going to say stuff like racially tinged, racially divisive. We're going to say racist. It's fewer letters. And the G word right now with what's going on in Gaza. We're not going to tiptoe around the idea that this could be a plausible genocide, to quote the International Court of Justice. We want to say things as they are, treat people with respect, wherever you are on the political spectrum, not have journalists and politicians patronize you. So it really is a platform for kind of blunt speaking, plain speaking, honest truths, I hope. That's what I hope it will be.
Well, congratulations on that. Ed or Corey, do you have any questions about it before we dive in?
Yeah, I'd, Mehdi, congratulations. Best of luck. What did you learn about the media landscape from your departure from MSNBC and the subsequent response to you, starting your own platform? What have you learned about American media today?
Well, what's interesting and sad is that since I announced I was quitting MSNBC on January 7th, I think it was, there has been a further bloodbath in our industry, right? There are outlets shutting down, people losing their jobs, and I'm not one of those people who celebrate that at all. While I have my criticisms of quote-unquote mainstream media, there are fantastic working journalists in all these places. But what it shows us is the business models aren't working. The old school, advertising, eyeballs, clicks, doesn't work, especially for kind of BuzzFeeds and Vices of this world. And what I'm trying to do is go down the subscriber model, is the paywall model, is treat people with respect, see that you have followings, see that you've built relationships with individuals, and I have followings both at home and abroad, given my career and my background, and letting people come to me because they trust what I'm going to give them. It's not just me, by the way. This is not a one-man band. This is not the Tucker Carlson Network. This is something where we're going to be rolling out a bunch of contributors, both American and foreign, on a whole host of issues come April. I think people will be very impressed with the people we have. So that's the idea, is to try and build that relationship, rebuild that trust in our industry. And it's interesting, Ed, isn't it, that people on the right have been doing this for a while, this direct relationship. Ben Shapiro has built up the Daily Wire into this behemoth, Barry Weiss and the Free Press, Tucker Carlson. No one on the progressive space has really tried it. So I thought, if not now, when? If not me, who?
We definitely encourage this. You know, we've been doing this podcasting business for 9 years. We pioneered the use of the other F word, but I'm not going to get into that. Certainly, Corey was not one of the pioneers of that. Do you have any questions or comments here, Corey, before we dive in?
I do. I'd love to know, you know, from your perspective as an entrepreneur, what are you what are the things that you're most worried about? Are you confident you have the financing you need to do the work you do? Are you finding the kind of talent that's going to drive a trusted model of journalism? What's keeping you up at night as you set sail on this venture, Mehdi?
It's a great question. And I've only been an entrepreneur for a couple of weeks, which is a strange thing to say. I'm 44 years old. I've been a happily W-2 guy for all of my life. And the idea now that I'm doing my own thing and employing other people is a little scary, but also exciting. I think for me, it is the subscription model, because there really is no precedent in the progressive space. I can't point to someone or something else. We raised a lot of money from investors, from people who are pissed at the current media setup. And we did that quite quickly and raised several million dollars. But I can't point to those people. I can't point to a model and say, look, we're copying this, because in my part of the political spectrum and media world, it really hasn't been done. So in that sense, there's no precedent, which makes me nervous. I've seen all the statistics about churn. I think, 40% of Netflix subscribers cancel during the year. So no matter how well we're doing now, I think there's that stress of how do we keep it going? We've had an amazing soft launch. We had 120,000 free subscribers in the first 10 days, which has way exceeded our expectations.
Congratulations.
Thank you. A big chunk of them paid. But again, I'm not going to rest on laurels. Momentum is everything. So we want to keep momentum up till our big launch in April. And I'm going to do the shameless plug before we continue. It's zateonews.com if you want to go check it out and maybe subscribe.
We encourage people to do it. We encourage other organizations. We are firmly ensconced in our role as the world's smallest media company. But seven years into it, being the world's smallest media company, we've never lost money. So there, all of you other media companies, we've always had this kind of old-fashioned idea, and feel free to borrow this one, Mehdi, and that is, don't spend more money than you've got.
Wow, that is that's profound, maybe profound.
Well, you'd be surprised. There are a lot of folks out there who have recently...
Jimmy Finkelstein and the Messenger.
Well, he certainly didn't get that message. I think a lot of folks didn't get that message. In any event, our focus is honest, expert conversation on difficult issues as well. This podcast, which has been going for almost a decade, is focused on foreign policy and national security. You mentioned Gaza. We are now into Ramadan. The ceasefire that was supposed to be has not happened. There's still some talk that it might, but it has not happened. The humanitarian crisis is growing worse, and the rift between Joe Biden and Bibi Netanyahu is as bad as it has ever been. I don't think it has helped that Joe Biden said there was a red line, which, by the way, I think he should have said, and Netanyahu then said, well, screw your red line. And I don't think it was helped subsequent to that when the intelligence community revealed that they have information that Netanyahu may be in political trouble. It's not the kind of thing that the intelligence community reveals unless they've been encouraged to reveal it. So we've got this kind of two-tier relationship. We're on both sides of this crisis at the moment. What's your take, Mehdi, about how it is? And specifically, because it's very easy to say Hamas is terrible and Netanyahu is doing a terrible job, about the Biden administration's handling it of it right now.
So, David, I've been reading your stuff religiously for many years, and I've agreed with a lot of what you've said about Biden administration's domestic policy, foreign policy, about Netanyahu, up until about October the 7th. I think the Biden administration has handled this horrendously, unforgivably, recklessly, immorally, and strategically stupidly. And I think on every level, it has been catastrophic, disastrous, especially in an election year. And you mentioned Ramadan. We are in Ramadan. You mentioned the red line. I mean, we all know what happened with Barack Obama and red line and Bashar al-Assad and how that was, held against him. And I think it was a stupid thing to say when you're not willing to enforce it. And where I differ with a lot of Democrats is I don't buy this argument that there is some big rift. I don't buy this argument that Biden doesn't have the power to rein Netanyahu in. Fundamentally, the more I think about this and the more I talk to people around Biden and the Democrats, this is him, right? This is coming from him. You can blame other people. You can blame aides. You can say it is him. He is driving this. At any moment, Biden could turn this around. And you've seen pro-Israel Democrats in Congress, the people like Brad Sherman and others. You know, forget the progressives, forget the squad. You've seen traditionally pro-Israel centrist Democrats saying, what the hell is going on here? Why are we giving Netanyahu this pass? This is a prime minister, David, as you well know, you served in the Clinton administration. Going back to Bill Clinton has screwed over every Democratic president of my lifetime. Bill Clinton, who famously came out of his meeting with Bibi to say, who the F is the superpower here? Barack Obama with the speech in Congress and opposing the nuclear deal. And now Joe Biden, who claims to be friends with Bibi for decades. And I just think, I keep wanting to pull my hair out and say, why in an election year would you risk your presidency and the future of American democracy if we genuinely believe Trump is an existential threat, which I do, why would you risk that for this guy who constantly undermines you? You say two-state solution, he says, I don't believe in it. You say red line Rafah, he says, I'm not going to abide by it. At what point does the United States say, answer Bill Clinton's question and say, who is the superpower here?
The way you set that up, it sounded like you disagreed with me starting on October 7th. I agree with 99% of what you just said. So I think we're pretty much.
I think you're more generous to Biden on the Gaza situation from my reading of
it. Well, I don't know. I hope not. But Corey, what's your take, response, question, or the slight cold you're getting there? I hope you feel better.
If you're tired of hearing ads, you can support the show by becoming a member. This week, listeners of the DSR Network shows can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, and early access to select podcasts. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DSRNetwork, one word, to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DSRNetwork. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, March 16th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
Yes, I'm quite hoarse. I was hoping that the hoarseness that came with my cold would make me sound like Lauren Bacall, but unfortunately, I think I sound more like Bogart than Bacall. So not a great look for me. So I agree with Mehdi's point that President Biden is himself driving this policy. And I'm glad Rosa's not here because she always grinds her teeth when I say all of the big mistakes of Biden administration foreign policy are the president's personal choices. And by the way, that's how a presidency should work, that the president actually drives policy. But I just don't think the president's reflexes are very good on defense issues in particular. And if you are going to set sail as he did with such a full-throated endorsement of Israel, I think it's not going to satisfy his critics for him to make a pivot, and it's certainly going to infuriate his supporters for him to do it. So again, it's like many Biden administration policies, he overcommits early on, doesn't think his way through it, and then pulls a lot of the negative aspects without getting the benefits by his half-heartedness. It feels of a piece with support for Ukraine, pulling the plug on Afghanistan and other things to me. A second thing I will say is that I'm quite frankly puzzled as to why the president ever believed he would have leverage over the choices of the Netanyahu government. That seems to me a fundamental misreading of the relationship. I mean, Bill Clinton's line is funny because he had so little influence over Israeli choices. And it's not clear to me why President Biden or others would think in the aftermath of the October 7th attack that they would have more influence over it.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I agree with you on all those points. So, Ed, let's just turn to you and, you know, liven this up a little. Why don't you just defend the Biden administration Gaza policy?
No, I can't. I don't find it defensible. I mean, I think this cartoon I've seen various iterations of America, Uncle Sam dropping a bomb with one hand and then peanuts with the other, pretty much captures the situation. That the U.S. is supplying so much of the offensive weaponry that is being used in contravention of the rules of law of war, including denying humanitarian corridors to the civilians of Gaza, and then saying it's going to build a pier off Gaza, that it'll take 2 months to set up and will only supply a fraction. It's better than nothing, but a fraction of the kind of assistance the civilians in Gaza need. This is not a change. There's been a rhetorical shift by Biden, I think, since the Michigan uncommitted vote. And I think at that point, Kamala Harris and others got quite alarmed about the potential electoral impact were this to remain the case, say Labor Day during the general election. And that's occasioned in the State of the Union, in an interview with MSNBC and one or two other places, Biden to say, look, there is this red line over Rafah. Netanyahu's worth does more harm to Israel than he does good. Benny Gantz is a great guy, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. We'd like to see him, in charge. We can do business with him, but no real concrete action. And I think it is entirely within America's power to sanction hundreds of people, for example, for the settlements. Four have been sanctioned, but they could sanction any number of people, including two cabinet ministers who live in the occupied territories. They could obviously put condition on offensive military aid. I don't believe they should withdraw defensive ones. The Iron Dome is a perfectly legitimate defense for Israel to have. But for offensive weapons that are being used in contradiction of American law, the humanitarian aid corridor law that says if you deny food and medicine to civilians, you shouldn't receive American weapons. Well, Israel is flagrantly and repeatedly in violation of that. So I think there is leverage there. And I think the Biden theory that you only have influence over Israel when there is no daylight with Israel is belied by America's history, the Bush senior administration, and by the Carter administration.
It's no question that that's the case. And, it was a revelation a couple of weeks ago in some media outlet that Biden referred to Netanyahu as an asshole. But actually, there's a long tradition of American presidents and senior officials referring to Netanyahu as an asshole, because, in fact, Netanyahu is an asshole. He's much worse than that, of course. It's not just that he has an unpleasant personality. Before we switch issues, Mehdi, maybe you want to respond to what Ed and Corey.
I do. I just wanted to jump in very briefly on the leverage point. Ed made the point about leverage. Just on Corey's point, I agree that in terms of internal Israeli politics, you know, switching out Netanyahu for another leader, America clearly doesn't have that power and wouldn't want to exercise that power. I don't think anyone in the Israeli political system has that power right now, such is the nature of Israeli parliamentary politics. But I think when it does, when it comes to weaponry, military aid, the Israelis have made it clear. And I wrote a piece for The Guardian recently on this subject, and I cited Yoav Gallant, the current defense secretary, and Yitzhak Brick, the former national security or deputy national security advisor, both of whom are on record saying since October the 7th, look, the Americans could end this tomorrow. We can't say no to the Americans when it comes to military aid. I think Brick used the phrase, they could turn off the tap tomorrow and stop us from doing what we want. So the Israelis are very clear that when it comes to offensive military aid, the Americans have huge leverage. The issue is Joe Biden doesn't want to use that leverage. Again, it comes back to Biden the man. He doesn't want to do a Ronald Reagan and make the call to beg in and say, stop this. Now, Corey can make the point, and I understand it. We're in a very different place after October 7th, where the Israelis are, you know, out for vengeance, revenge, security, supposedly, and they're probably not going to listen to entreaties or pleas. But, you know, the big stick is there should a U.S. president choose to use it. The problem is this president won't.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, I've spoken to a number of Israelis in the past 24 hours who were net kind of Biden supporters, not Netanyahu supporters, and they've sort of turned the corner in the past couple of days in disgust with the fact that the United States is not putting more pressure on right now when it realizes that this this notion that there is any leverage at all, or that somehow, for some reason, the Israelis will begin to do the right thing when that has not been their inclination at any point in this, will happen. Let me switch gears here and talk a little bit about Ukraine, because I find that we're in this shocking place where, you know, the administration has requested aid for Ukraine. The majority of people in the Congress apparently want aid for Ukraine. There was a hearing this week in which the director of Central Intelligence, among others, said, if we do not provide the aid to Ukraine, there are going to be significant reversals or worse come later this year. The Europeans are stepping up. The administration managed to scrape together $300 million out of so-called Pentagon savings, which is a fascinating concept we'll have to devote an entire show to. We are at a moment at which what is arguably or was arguably one of the biggest success stories of the Biden administration foreign policy has been gutted, thanks directly to the handiwork of Donald Trump and his Keebler elf, Mike Johnson. What do you think of this meeting?
It's so depressing, the entire situation. And, you know, we are a country of amnesiacs, but I'm old enough to remember when the tanks rolled in 2022 and the entire world and nation and much of our political class was united behind Ukrainians fighting for their survival, stunning the world. By staying independent, repelling Russian invaders. And we've reached that point now. It reminds me of January the 6th in many ways, where actually, you know, we talk about a divided country, but there are issues on which we unite. We did unite around Ukraine, mostly. And we did unite after January 6th, even Republicans saying, this is wrong. And yet the power of the right-wing propaganda machine is so strong in this country that it can literally rewrite events in real time, rewrite our approach to what we're seeing in front of us, our reality. And therefore, today you have a bunch of Americans on the right who think January the 6th was some patriotic movement and everyone in prison are hostages. And you can believe that Ukraine is this kind of Nazi state that is, stealing money off America and that Putin just wants to, look out for Russian defense. And what's interesting is I'm someone who's on the left and I'm not comfortable with American military aid to foreign countries. I'm not comfortable with what wars that might look like proxy wars. I'm not comfortable with endless wars. I'm certainly not comfortable with the idea of a nuclear confrontation, which has always been the risk in Ukraine. But where I part ways, of course, with the Republican Party is, A, I'm not an isolationist. B, I don't have a thing for Vladimir Putin. And C, you know, to quote Keynes, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? lots of things have changed in Ukraine. I'm someone who wants a negotiated end to the conflict. But when you hear Vladimir Putin saying, as he has said this week in an interview that is doing the rounds on social media, why would I negotiate with Ukraine just because they're running out of ammo? That kind of does remind you from the horse's mouth, quiet part loud, that this is a guy who's not interested in peaceful negotiations, is not interested in some mutually agreeable conclusion to this conflict. And that is the fundamental problem at the heart of all of this, which is we all know there has to be a negotiated end to this conflict. But at the same time, the idea that Vladimir Putin is a good faith actor is absurd. And then you've got this Republican Party that just wants to throw everyone under the bus. And I actually don't know how bad Donald Trump will be on this issue. I've been so focused on all of other Trump's evil deeds and dastardly plans and Bond villain-esque proposals for a second term. I haven't put that much thought into just how bad the situation will get in Ukraine. I would just say one last general point on Ukraine, which is I also find it deeply depressing that the kind of the Venn diagram of the people who support Ukrainian resistance against occupation and Palestinian resistance against occupation is a very small circle.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. I want to get Corey and Ed's reaction to this and carry this forward, but this is the moment where we typically in each of our podcasts say thanks very much to everybody for joining us. And if you're not a member, you should go become a member because then you could listen to the rest of this. We're all for you supporting Medi's new operation, but, you know, support ours too. Go to the DSRnetwork.com, click on membership, become a member. I think it's $7 a month. It helps support what we do. It also allows you to hear the rest of the content of every podcast we're doing, which is now, I think, 17 podcasts a week. So that's a lot of extra content. For now, if you're not a member, bye-bye. And if you are a member, stand by.